Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Following the town of Camden's short-lived immigration enforcement agreement with ICE, one advocate is calling on the state to prevent such agreements.
Yes, we want to get rid of the criminals. I'm one for getting rid of criminals, but that's not what's happening. What's happening is if you look like you're an immigrant, you'll be stopped and taken in.
We sit down with Latin American Community Center Executive Director Maria Matos to discuss the issue. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn more about a new study that offers hope for kids with brittle bone disease. Arts Playlist focuses on the Delaware Symphony's latest effort to connect kids with classical music. And Enlighten Me explains how a new tattoo shop became a first for new art. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The role of local law enforcement in federal immigration enforcement was center stage in Delaware recently when the town of Camden quietly entered into and then quickly ended an immigration enforcement agreement with ICE known as a 287G agreement. These agreements allow local police to collaborate with ICE, but critics argue they can erode trust within immigrant communities. One of those critics is the executive director of the Latin American Community Center in Wilmington, Maria Matos, who recently penned an op-ed calling for a statewide ban on these agreements. This week, I sat down with Matos to discuss her concerns and the impact these agreements can have on Delaware communities. So I want to start with the agreements themselves. The agreement that the town of Camden entered into briefly was what's known as a 287G agreement. Can you explain a little bit about what they are and why they are problematic for communities, particularly here in Delaware?
What the agreement does is it extends the law enforcement's power to act as immigration officials. So they can arrest you for, I don't know, having a green card, not having a green card or not having papers. They stop you. They ask you for your immigration status. And I find that the immigrant community tends to tell the truth all the time. You know, in spite that they may get in trouble by telling the truth, they tend to be honest and hardworking people. And what it does, it gives the police officers, and the state of Delaware hasn't had a good history with police and communities of color. You know, we all know that. We've been working to get it better, and it is getting better. You know, there is a lot of people, a lot of police officers and those that are in charge working hard to make sure that the relationship between the communities continue to improve. But it hasn't been the best. So extending the law enforcement's power, not only to state issues or criminal issues or, I don't know, local stops, extended it, giving it more power as immigration. It has a lot of problems. Number one, they're not trained. Number two, we got some hotheads in our community, in our police force. Number three, there's a lot of racism. You know, I started my career in advocacy, fighting police brutality. I was arrested. I was involved in a riot. I mean, I was 25. I'm 75 now. That was like, you know, many, many years ago. But the thing is, I was 25 at the time. I'm 75 right now, and it's still going on. So I find it that it's a problem giving police officers more power than what they need.
One of the other issues you pointed out in your op-ed is that agreements like the one in Camden can also catch communities off guard. Why is that lack of transparency around these agreements also a significant issue? This one in Camden, really, nobody really knew about until after the fact.
That's a good question for our governor. I hate to put him on the spot, but that's a good question for him. Why is it that it caught us by surprise? Why didn't his office know? I mean, we're a small state. If it can't be done in Delaware, it can't be done anywhere. And we have to protect those that can't protect themselves. And, you know, there's no one waiting in line to pick mushrooms or strawberries in the middle of the heat in July. Who's going to go to the farms? So if we as a community gather our strength and say, no, we're not going to permit this in Delaware, we could do it. You know, that there is a risk that the Trump administration will not send us money. Yeah, there's a risk, but we can always go to court. You know, the work has to be done. It's not like he's in charge and that's it. His word is last and foremost. There are avenues that we can take to prevent him from making us another Hitler era. I don't know, something like that. But I believe that we can stop the 287G from happening across the state with a simple bill that one of the legislatures ought to put in place.
Well, you kind of alluded to earlier that there's a matter of trust, right, between law enforcement and communities, particularly communities of color. In the wake of this, what have you been hearing from community members about the impact these agreements have on that fundamental trust between the immigrant community and local law enforcement?
Well, they're not going to report crimes. They're not going to call the police if they're in trouble. You know, the work that has been done in the past 30 years to bring community of colors, immigrant communities, as a partner with police will dissolve because the trust is not there. How can you be an enforcer if that's not your job when you're telling me a police officer is your friend? Is your friend when you are in need? Is your friend when you are in trouble? Is your friend when somebody's committing a crime against you? Or you see a crime being committed, you're not going to call the police. First of all, the trust is not there 100%. We're still working on building that trust throughout the years. And it's just not going to improve if the community hears that the police has agreed to be an arm of the immigration enforcement so that they can deport you.
You mentioned some possible solutions at the state level, but before we get to that, I do want to ask, from the local government level, what would you like local governments to do if they're approached about these type of agreements, perhaps involving the public, perhaps, before entering in these agreements? Should there be a process there? So again, it's not something that people learn about after the fact as opposed to, you know, beforehand or have a chance to weigh in on?
No, did you just say no? We don't want to hear about it. Just say no. Have enough strength or backbone to say no. Our police, number one, we're stretched thin. Most of them do not have sufficient police officers to manage the crime as it is. And number two, our officers are not trained. They're not trained. And number three, we don't want to break that trust that we've built in the community. So the answer should be, don't check with anybody. The mayors of every single town, the governor should take a stand and say, no, in Delaware, we're not going to have this. There will be no agreements. The attorney general ought to step in here and protect the people that work, that live and work in this state. Yes, we want to get rid of the criminals. I'm one for getting rid of criminals, but that's not what's happening. What's happening is if you look like you're an immigrant, you'll be stopped and taken in.
We've seen states like New Jersey, Connecticut, and Illinois already ban local municipalities and state agencies from entering into these 287G agreements. It sounds like you're saying that that's ultimately the solution you'd like to see. Is that the one you see as being most effective, at least in regard to these 287G agreements?
State ban, statewide ban. Just say no. Just say no to 287G.
There are already more than 10 pro-immigrant bills pending in the state legislature right now. Now, one that was heard this week was HB 58 that would prohibit Delaware law enforcement officers from stopping, questioning, arresting, searching, or detaining people based on their immigration status or civil immigration violations and from asking about immigration status or acting on civil immigration warrants. Is that a bill that could effectively head off these issues with 287Gs?
Well, racial profiling is against the law anyway. We know that they shouldn't do it, but they do it. So, no, I don't believe it goes far enough. I don't believe it's deep enough. I mean, I think the bill is good because it protects those that can't protect themselves. But it's not a statewide ban. I agree with House Bill 58. I think it should get out of committee and land in the agenda, and to be voted and sent over to the Senate. But it doesn't go deep enough.
The other bill that was heard this week was HB 96, in the House at least. That would require Delaware's Division of Civil Rights and Public Trust to submit quarterly reports on any federal requests for state law enforcement assistance related to immigration, including data sharing, involvement in schools, churches, and migrant education programs. I'm going to assume that you feel like that's also just a step, not an end, but is that a good step?
That's an excellent step. 96 is a good step. 96 is a good step. It needs to get out of committee and be voted on and sent over to the Senate and signed by the governor.
One of the things you mentioned was the Attorney General's involvement. And I guess one of the reasons why I want to bring that up is because we've seen the Trump administration putting pressure on states and municipalities. Earlier this week, Delaware Attorney General Kathy Jennings joining a coalition of 19 attorneys general to file two separate lawsuits against the Trump administration over illegal immigration conditions put on billions of dollars in federal funding used for things like emergency services and infrastructure projects. From your perspective, how much does this kind of pressure that the Trump administration is putting on local governments financially to get them involved in immigration enforcement concern you?
You know, fear always hinders anybody, everybody. Fear is something that immobilizes the human being. But we need to stick together. If we have to do with less as a state, then we do with less. But we can't allow for people to be dehumanized, put behind bars because they're looking for a place to feed their families. Yes, fear. Fear does. You know, immobilize you. It does, no matter what kind of fear it is. But I think that if we look at it from a human point of view, not from a dollar point of view, we can make it if we make it together and protect ourselves and protect each other.
Well, and I guess that brings us to the idea of what else can be done beyond the legislative piece, right? Is there something that needs to be done just in terms of just the general political and societal atmosphere centering around immigration and talking about immigration and what needs to be done versus, what is taking things too far?
Take an offense. As a white person, take offense. As a black person, take offense. Not only Latinos can take offense, but as a white person, you know, when the women's movement was impacted, it was when white women joined the fight. You know, when the Jews were being removed from their streets or from their homes and put in concentration camps, it was those Germans that didn't turn a blind eye that helped some survive. So don't turn a blind eye. Take a stand and take a stand for human rights, for what's right and just. That's all that takes. You know it in your heart. You know it in your soul, what's right and what's wrong. You know, we're supposed to be a Christian country. Well, what did Jesus say? Well, do what Jesus does. Take care of the person that's next to you that can't take care of themselves because they don't have the right to be undocumented in this country. You know, and think about the amount of money that these immigrants put in our Social Security that they will never use. But you and I will. That is, unless he takes away the citizenship of Puerto Ricans. So then I'll go back to Puerto Rico. Who knows? You know, take a stand for what's right and just. That's all I say.
Thanks to Latin American Community Center Executive Director Maria Matos for joining me on The Green this week. And next up on The Green, a look at how new research from Nemours Children's Health is challenging long-held assumptions about a rare genetic disorder known as brittle bone disease. You're listening to The Green here on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. A prenatal diagnosis of osteogenesis imperfecta, a rare genetic disorder also known as brittle bone disease, can be devastating for expecting parents. The most severe cases are often labeled lethal, leading some families to believe there are no options for treatment. But new research from Nemours Children's Health challenges that belief and finds that many of these infants not only survive, but can significantly benefit from timely medical treatment. Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon recently caught up with Dr. Ricky Carroll, a physician on the skeletal dysplasia and palliative care teams at Nemours, to learn more about the study's findings and how doctors are rethinking this rare condition.
Dr. Carroll, let's start with the basics here before we get to your study. What exactly is osteogenesis imperfecta, which is also known commonly as OI or brittle bone disease, which I'll be sticking to both of those for the most part today. So what is OI? How fatal is it? How common is it? You know, when is it diagnosed? How is it detected? There's a lot going on here. So if you could just give us the rundown on brittle bone disease.
I typically refer to it as OI. So OI is a condition that is typically caused by a change in the collagen 1 gene. So collagen 1 is really important for your bones and really important for kind of the strength and the like building block kind of the bone, or kind of the structure of the bone. So a change in the collagen 1 gene makes the bones more fragile and more likely to fracture. Many, but not all, people with OI have a change in that gene. And then there can be other associated conditions with OI outside of the skeleton. So for example, OI can also affect the teeth. It can cause something called dentinogenesis imperfecta, or DI, which causes brittleness to the teeth. It can cause blue sclera. So the whites of the eyes might have like a blue or gray tint to them. Some people with OI have that, some people don't. In general, skeletal dysplasias are very rare, and OI is very rare. And OI is a spectrum. So it's like it's a very wide spectrum condition.
You know, for you at Nemours Children's Health, how often, at least anecdotally, doctor, how often does Nemours treat brittle bone disease, regardless of when it's diagnosed and whatnot? Are you able to anecdotally, you know, give us an idea of what that looks like?
Yeah, I mean, I'm part of a big multidisciplinary team. I think of myself as being on kind of the medical side of the OI team. You know, myself as a kind of a complex care pediatrician. We have also a physician who's a geneticist on our team. We work with genetic counselors, nurse practitioners, and PAs. And then we work really closely with our orthopedic colleagues, physical therapy, anesthesia, neurosurgery when needed, ENT when needed, pulmonology when needed. So we're kind of a big team. We all work together to care for these patients. And we start as early as prenatally. So we have an advanced delivery unit, and we'll sometimes see moms who, you know, parents who have been given a diagnosis for their baby as having OI. When we meet with them prenatally, and if the family decides, they can even deliver here at Nemours, and then we would care for that baby in our NICU. So we always, you know, we commonly have a baby or two with OI in our NICU. For children outside of the hospital setting, we have a multidisciplinary clinic, and we see patients on Mondays in that clinic. So we'll see, you know, a handful of patients with OI on Monday afternoons as a multidisciplinary team. And then we also use certain medications that help to strengthen the bone, and those are via infusion. And so those patients will come into our infusion center during the week for those infusions. So on any given week, we'll see, you know, 5 to 15 patients with OI.
I can imagine how difficult a diagnosis of OI is for parents, but How do you and the team at Nemours navigate that and counsel parents through it?
Yeah, I think for families who are just being given the diagnosis for the first time, it can be overwhelming. Families come to us in all different avenues. It's uncommon for us to be giving them the first diagnosis. Typically, someone else has already told the family, you know, we're concerned about OI and we want you to see this team. If a family is coming to us prenatally, I do a, you know, our team does a prenatal consult and we sit and talk about what OI is and we talk about the spectrum. The OIF, Osteogenesis Imperfecta Foundation, is a national foundation that has a ton of resources for families. It has like a prenatal toolkit or a toolkit for families when they first are given a diagnosis, and that's for free on their website. And we'll sometimes print that out for families. We'll try to connect them with other families so that they can see other, you know, infants, toddlers, children with OI that are thriving to kind of, and give them other families that are, can be a resource to them as they navigate this, you know, new diagnosis and new future. And that's prenatally, but there are some families who come to us in clinic. So there's a lot of different ways that you can kind of end up with our team. And we try to support the family wherever they are.
Right. Well, pivoting to the study, you and your colleagues examined cases of 18 infants with brittle bone disease who were cared for in the Nemours NICU between September of 2019 and August of last year, that being 2024. 12 of those 18 have been given a prenatal diagnosis of, quote, lethal or, quote, possibly lethal OI. 4 were diagnosed with less severe forms of OI, and severity-specific diagnostic information was not available for the remaining 2. All 18 infants survived to hospital discharge, and 16 are alive today with minimal breathing or feeding support needs. Those findings would appear to dispel this long-held narrative that brittle bone disease is automatically fatal when diagnosed before birth, but from where you sit, Dr. Carroll, what do you make of your study's findings and what they mean in the overall picture of how we generally view and diagnose and treat brittle bone disease?
Yeah, I think that what it tells us is that we're really, you know, we don't have the tools to be able to prognosticate how a baby with OI is going to do right now. And so we should be really hesitant to give the diagnosis of quote unquote lethal OI because we don't as a medical society have really good tools or know really how to prognosticate on how an infant with OI is going to do long term. You know, the common phrase that we use is genotype doesn't equal phenotype. And what that means is that we know that even when people have the exact same gene change, their OI can look very different. Like even within a family, like siblings who have the exact same gene change in the collagen 1 gene can look really different with their OI. And that's because we have lots of other genes in our body and because our environment matters and our diet matters and our activity matters and all these other things that affect our body and our growth and our development and who we are and how our skeleton grows and all of those things. So, you know, just looking at the gene alone and looking in the literature and seeing a case report of a baby who, you know, had a gene change who died doesn't mean automatically that the baby in front of you is also going to die.
So going forward then, whether it's the, you know, using the right language and terminology and getting away from the term lethal and other things that encompasses or other forms of that word, as far as what you want future research to look like or to examine, you know, from as far as caring for infants with OI goes, from delivery to physical therapy, what would you like that research to look like going forward? And then also, I'm curious as far as the amount of physicians that have experience in this realm that are charged with treating this, Is it kind of a hand-in-hand thing to bolster the amount of physicians with experience with OI and treating OI and caring for infants with OI, along with kind of reimagining the approach to this kind of research? Are those two things kind of is that a package deal? What are your thoughts there?
So, what I will say are, a couple of things that I want to say. The first thing that I want clinicians to take away from this paper is that we should be hesitant to use the term lethal and that we should be offering life-sustaining interventions for these families. A lot of babies with OI can survive. And so for some families who want to trial life-sustaining interventions, I think that's very reasonable, and I think that all families should be offered that as an option. In terms of future research, I think that we need to be thinking about how we can better prognosticate. So, are there any clear or more accurate signs for a baby in utero where we can tell a family, because there are some babies that truly their OI is so significant that there's not enough lungs there to be able for the baby to breathe, to get oxygen in and carbon dioxide out, no matter how much medical support we give them. And it would be nice to be able to figure out which babies are that early on. And so studying, the prenatal factors, maybe getting additional early prenatal imaging might be helpful. So that's kind of the next research step I would think about. And then, in terms of your second question, I want to get the word out. I want teams to know that we should be offering these things to families and that there's possibility that these babies can survive. But I also think that a multidisciplinary team is really important for these infants. And so, we always encourage teams and families to reach out to us so that we can help from afar or help bring the infant here for specialized care.
Thanks to Dr. Ricky Carroll, a physician on the skeletal dysplasia and palliative care teams at Nemours Children's Hospital, and our Kyle McKinnon for joining us on The Green this week. Up next, Arts Playlist, where we learn how the Delaware Symphony Orchestra is giving local students a chance to experience classical music from a live orchestra this month. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Delaware Symphony Orchestra is introducing local students to the world of classical music through its upcoming Explorer Concerts. These performances give young audiences a chance to experience live orchestral music in an engaging setting, with educators receiving lesson plans and materials to help prepare the students ahead of time. In this week's edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny talks with Delaware Symphony Orchestra CEO J.C. Barker about these Explorer Concerts and the benefits for students and schools.
Well, tell me, what is an Explorer's Concert?
Well, so the Explorer Concerts are concerts that we do every year, and they are concerts for children, kids. And this year we'll be doing concerts both in Wilmington and in Dover. We've fallen into that pattern in the past few years, and we are really excited. I mean, the concerts will be on the 20th here in Wilmington at the Grand Opera House and the 21st at Dover High School. We have kids that come in from all around just to experience an orchestra, many of them, if not all of them, for the first time. And it's a fun concert. It's not very long. It's upbeat. And we try to make it interesting. And this year, we have a really interesting work that we are excited about that we hope will really engage these young minds.
Tell me a little bit about that music.
Well, it's a piece that I've known about and heard. It's going to sound a little, it sounds a little macabre. It is called The Composer is Dead. And it's written by a guy named Nathaniel Stuckey, and it's after the Lemony Snicket book. And it's basically kind of a little light murder mystery using instruments of the orchestra as, different conspirators and the whole situation. And it's interesting. And of course, many kids know Lemony Snicket, but to see that literary work taken and transformed into something that's interactive with orchestra is really great. We'll also have another couple of pieces on the program. We'll have a big famous march by Johann Strauss, and we've got a piece by Samuel Coleridge Taylor that opens, which is big and exciting. So it's a great experience for these kids to hear an orchestra for the first time, actually see all the instruments, hear all the different instruments, and hopefully stir a little enthusiasm and interest.
Of course, the symphony has a new conductor just recently announced, Michelle DeRusso. She makes her debut as music director in October. Who's conducting these concerts?
We are excited this year to invite Jim Anderson, who is going to be conducting. Jim is the director of orchestral studies at University of Delaware, and I've been looking for an opportunity to engage with Jim, and he's going to be leading both these concerts.
What will the kids see when they walk into the venue for the first time? What are they going to see? What will it be like for them?
They walk in and they see a large group of musicians on the stage warming up. So it's a lot of chaos at the beginning when the kids are coming in, and of course they're a little chaotic too, and the orchestra's chaotic. And then they go through basically the experience that really all of us do with an orchestra concert, where they see it all calm down, and they see the concert master come out and tune the orchestra and find some focus to the chaos that's surrounding. And then the conductor comes out and we'll talk and then start the concert. And I love being at these concerts, because to see the kids that have never seen or heard anything like this before and watch their faces is just incredible. It is incredible. I remember the first time I heard something like this, and it was life-changing. So that's the experience. And they leave and are excited and hope they tell their friends and their parents. And many of them will be at a point where they are just beginning to start to consider being in a music program in a school. And so we hope that helps inspire them.
The Explorer concerts are not the only education outreach that the orchestra does. What else does the orchestra do in terms of education?
We regularly send groups of musicians, or sometimes single musicians, into schools and into working with our community partners. Here in Wilmington, we work with the Christina Cultural Arts, are starting to work with YMCA and some of their centers. They have preschool centers and daycare centers. And we also send larger groups. We'll send a brass quintet or string quartet into schools that already have established music programs, or sometimes that don't, to work often with their orchestras and their bands. Some of the school districts in Delaware have what's called a strings day, where they bring all the strings in from the district, and they have a quartet or a quintet from the Delaware Symphony that comes in and leads that, does master classes, plays with the kids, and those are great experiences too. The Explorer concerts are big, and so the interpersonal interaction is not as intense as some of the smaller groups, but the smaller groups are always fun. I've done some myself, actually. I still play the clarinet, and I've gone down on occasion to Christina and played for the 4 and 5 year olds, and that's one of my favorite things to do.
It's obvious that this is a really rewarding experience for the kids, but what about the musicians in the orchestra? I would think this has to be a really fun, fulfilling experience for them also.
It absolutely is. It absolutely is. And There's kind of a connection. I've never really thought about this, but when a musician in an orchestra, say like myself, is having this experience playing for younger kids, it kind of takes us back to that place where we were that kid with the rapt attention. It's almost like you feel a little kindred experience that you're having. And I think also it's just exciting for musicians to see the excitement of these young people for what they do. It's a type of validation, if you will. And it keeps coming because the older we get, the more kids we get, and it goes on and on.
We're at a moment right now where funding for arts and funding for arts education is being threatened. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the importance of music education, arts education in general, and why it's so crucial to kids' development.
It makes better human beings. I often say that the work that the symphony and when we go to play for kids, we're not in the business of trying to create brilliant violinists and clarinet players and trumpet players. We love it when that happens. But more than anything, we know that the arts in general and music specifically is part of creating a well-rounded human. And when those experiences are not there, it creates a deficit in character, to be blunt. And we see it all around us. But it is definitely part of the puzzle of education in general. And to see what's going on with funding is a little frightening, to be honest with you. I will say here in Delaware, we have incredible foundations and incredible individuals that continue to recognize the importance of this type of work and have stepped up and continue to step up. Unfortunately, I don't know that it's that way everywhere in the country. And in the denser areas like Newcastle County, it's sometimes challenging because you see so many kids that need this type of exposure to this type of work that are not getting it because there are just so many. But no, it's something we certainly watch. We've watched very closely over the past few months, and we will continue to adjust. Continue to do as much as we can possibly do and pivot, as we used to like to say in COVID.
As we talked about earlier, the orchestra has selected a new conductor, Michelle DeRusso. She's 34 years old, born in Argentina, with a really, really impressive resume. Without giving anything away, which I know you won't, can you talk sort of in general about Michelle's approach to programming the orchestra? Is she more traditionalist, more modern? How will she program music for this orchestra?
A combination. And Michelle is incredibly enthusiastic, and she has a really amazing energy that she brings. She is from Argentina, and I know that some of our folks have seen her when she was certainly here for her audition, but she was also with us 2 years ago as a guest conductor and did a program of all Latin American music. I can say that it will be a mix of things. It certainly won't all be Latin American, but there are new brilliant works being written for orchestra every day. And the Delaware Symphony has a long history of championing American composers. And so we will continue to do that. But it will be a mix. It will be a mix of what's new and certainly what we call the canon of our repertoire. So there will be Beethoven, there will be Tchaikovsky, there will be Rachmaninoff. But we'll also love introducing audiences to newer works. And I will say that in Delaware, in general, we have a very open group of concert attendees, patrons that really embrace this newer music. And when those works are performed and they're performed with great enthusiasm by our brilliant musicians, it opens horizons. And that's what we're here to do.
Thanks to Delaware Symphony Orchestra CEO J.C. Barker and R. Martin Matheny for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. And we wrap up the green next with Enlighten Me, where our University of Delaware intern Jack Silverberg tells us how a recently opened tattoo shop became a first for the city of Newark. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. For years, tattoo shops were kept out of Newark, essentially blocked by city code. But that changed recently, thanks to the efforts of one determined tattoo artist who led the push to rewrite the rules. In this edition of Enlighten Me, University of Delaware senior and Delaware Public Media intern Jack Silverberg reports on the story behind Newark's first legal tattoo parlor and the woman who made it happen.
The buzz of a tattoo gun cuts through the silence of Main Street. For the first time in the city of Newark, ink now flows legally.
I was extremely nervous. I don't think I've ever been that nervous in my life. But it was fun.
That's Brittany Lopez, owner of B13 Tattoos, which recently celebrated its grand opening as the first tattoo shop in Newark. Lopez says the new shop is a major milestone on her journey as a tattoo artist. A journey that had humble beginnings.
It became like a kind of like a little hobby on the side. And then unfortunately we went into the pandemic and we were on lockdown. And that's when I decided to take tattooing pretty serious. And I kind of never put the tattoo machine down since.
Her initial shop was in the North Wilmington area. Then when she looked to move, she thought she found an area that offered a good opportunity.
So in my head, I'm like, all right, well, let me look out Newark. And then I realized there were no tattoo shops in this particular area within, you know, a radius. I was ready to sign my lease. And then we're like, hold on, let's double check. And when we double checked that I was not allowed here, that's why there was none around me.
While Newark didn't outright ban tattoo shops from opening, it wasn't explicitly allowed either. Confused? Let City Councilman Jason Lawhorn explain.
If you look at our code and through all the different districts, there's what's called allowable uses. And Newark code is pretty specific about what you're allowed to do. So if it doesn't say you're allowed to do it, then in effect, you're not allowed to do it, right?
And tattoo shops fell into that space.
There was a gentleman that reached out to me and one other council member about opening up a tattoo shop in Newark. I brought it up at council and it was pretty adamantly no interest given.
Enter Brittany Lopez, whose desire to bring her shop to Newark opened the door for Lawhorn to revisit the issue.
So then flash forward to this past year, we had this young woman come forward. We had a discussion on council at that point, and the question was, are we willing to even entertain the conversation about making it allowable use? And I was strongly for it. Through our discussion, council decided, yes, we'll have a formal conversation about it.
And Lawhorn says the numbers backed up his position that it was time for a change.
Basically, I argued that, you know, some of it's generational. If you look at the older age groups, a very small percentage of people have tattoos. And then when you go to younger ages, it was more than half of people have at least one tattoo.
Tattoos are becoming less stigmatized. What used to be considered a deviance from the norm now carries emotional weight for those who participate in tattoo culture.
It's more than just a body art thing. Our society has moved in how we view tattoos.
Lopez hopes to build on that change and set a new image for tattoos in Newark through her brand.
I keep things very private. So I think I am able to make a little bit more of an impact on the safe space with a business that is, you know, has that reputation of You walk in, there's, a lot going on, a lot of music, a lot of noise, people hanging out, where I do the complete opposite. I'm here to bring, what Main Street needs. And if it is a little pain with a little love and a little art, then I am here for it, definitely.
Councilman Lawhorn was Lopez's first customer at B13. He expects the business will connect with the University of Delaware's community, diversifying Main Street's appeal to students.
So it was a way to take a business that our students are using anyway and put it, in their environment, in their area, so they don't have to travel all the way up to North Wilmington. And it just adds some artistic diversity to Main Street as well.
For Delaware Public Media, I'm Jack Silverberg.
Thanks to UD Senior and Delaware Public Media intern Jack Silverberg for enlightening us this week. And that's all we have time for on this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible. University of Delaware intern Jack Silverberg, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny, and our senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns. Thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into A First State of Mind.